I believe that natural history has lost much by the vague general treatment that is so common. What satisfaction would be derived from a 10-page sketch of the habitats and customs of man? How much more profitable would it be to devote that space to the life of one great man? This is the principle I have endeavored to apply to my animals. The real personality of the individual and his view of life are my theme, rather than the ways of the race in general, as viewed by casual and hostile human eyes. Ernest Thompson Seton wrote a bestseller, Wild Animals I Have Known, in 1898, when there was a lot more room for those wild animals to roam free in America. In today's rapidly developing world, how can people coexist with wild animals, especially wolves, bears, and big cats? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Adrian Travis, Professor of Environmental Studies at the UW-Madison Nelson Institute of Environmental Studies. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks for inviting me, Norman. Pleasure to be here.
It's a topic that can actually go global very quickly, but I think we'll probably narrow it down closer to home for the sake of getting some prime examples. And these public attitudes toward various animals seem to be evolving fairly quickly over time. If we just start with wolves, for example, they're good, they're bad. You know, there was a bounty, 100 years ago or so, and now it's a fine if you shoot one. So how have all these changes come about?
Well, that's a great question. Partly, there's been a seismic shift in societal attitudes towards wild animals and towards nature in general. And you can characterize that shift as being one towards more mutualism, which is a belief system that animals are part of our community and they deserve respect and proper treatment. And that can take many forms when people believe it. But what's striking about the nationwide surveys that have been conducted by folks like Dr. Jeremy Bruscotter, Dr. Michael Manfredo, Dr. Tara Teal, is that across the country, everywhere they sample in every state, that shift towards mutualism has grown strongly. And it's really characteristic of the next generation of youths and the people who are going to take our place, Norman. So this is probably a trend that'll continue, and we'll see a complete transformation of how the U.S. public views wild animals.
Well, one radical change is not only do we not encourage people to shoot wolves, but we actually import wolves into some states.
Right. You're referring to Colorado, I take it, as the most recent case.
Yes.
Yeah. So in 2023, Coloradans finally implemented what had been a ballot referendum a few years earlier, where the public voted in the regular course of their elections, they voted for reintroduction of wolves to the state. And at the time, Colorado had a few wild wolves that had come back on their own, probably from Wyoming. But the ballot referendum authorized the state agencies to put one or two what we call packs of wolves into the wild in parts of north and western Colorado, where they can find that they have an abundant prey base, mainly elk and mule deer and so forth.
Why did Coloradans and people in other states want to bring wolves into the state?
Well, I can't pretend to speak for all of the public. I'm sure there's diverse motivations out there, one of them probably being this shift I was talking about towards mutualistic values towards nature. Viewing the prior eradication of wolves in Colorado and many other regions as illegitimate, unjustified, a wrong that had to be remedied. And I'm sure there are others who did it for the pure aesthetic or spiritual view of wolves as this beautiful native wild animal of North America that Colorado once had. Then there might be members of the public who realize that the ecosystem was unhealthy without them. So for example, turning to Wisconsin, we have good research here from Dr. Jennifer Rayner here at University of Wisconsin indicating that counties with wolves have fewer vehicle collisions between white-tailed deer and cars. And those counties then are saving millions in property damage every year. They're saving people's lives and saving deer lives as well by hosting wolves within the county as compared to counties that don't contain wolves, and also as compared to the counties prior to wolves coming back. So as you know, here in Wisconsin, the history of recolonization of the state has been gradual, spreading geographically, so that some counties have had wolves for a long period, other counties for very briefly, and there are counties that still do not have breeding wolf packs. They may have an occasional visitor, but no breeding wolf packs. And across that range of states, one sees differences in these deer vehicle collisions, with the counties having wolves having fewer of the collisions. We also see healthier forests and more valuable forests to people. And there I'm citing research by Dr. Don Waller and colleagues.
Well, when we talk about wild animals, I guess the first thing we think about is the predators, the wolves and the mountain lions and
sorry
bears.
To jump in, Norman, but most people think of deer and elk first.
Well, I was going to say deer are so plentiful in Wisconsin, and I guess have been for a long time. I read somewhere that there are actually more deer in America now than there were when Columbus arrived, which might make sense, I guess, given the wolf population change decline over those last 500 years. But we almost think of deer as tame animals, as domestic, because they're so common. And some of them, the various conservancies around Madison, for example, are so tame that you can go up within 15 feet and talk to them. And so there is the predator and the prey when you're talking about wild animals. And the deer have become out of balance for people and for the deer's own well-being, you're saying?
Yeah. The evidence is pretty overwhelming that the population of deer in Wisconsin and most of the U.S., the populations of deer are too high for the forests, for the diversity of understory plants. Take a species like the nodding trillium, a beautiful flowering plant a lot of people value. It struggles wherever there are too many deer because the deer are browsing, grazing, eating pretty much any vegetation they can reach, especially in the months, where there's a shortage of food. And a lot of understory plants like the trillium can't make it under those conditions. However, research by Dr. Callen indicated that at the center of wolf pack territories, you get things like nodding trillium coming back and several other understory plant species. So when I talk about the health of forests, I'm talking about that diversity of different plants, not just the trees, but we're also talking about the structure of the forests, where you get more mature trees, you get a better resistance to these non-native plant invasions. And all of these factors also trickle down to an economic benefit for people. Where we're harvesting forests, say for timber, you get a better structure, I don't know the terminology, yards of wood, whatever. You get higher value from the forest in those areas where the deer are not so much reduced in number. That's less important than that the deer are fearful of wolves. So by being fearful of wolves, the deer move on. They keep moving. They don't settle in one spot, eat it down to the ground, and then move to the next patch. Instead, they're nibbling here, moving, nibbling there, moving again. And it's that constant movement and vigilance that gives the vegetation a chance to bounce back and improves the health and diversity of the forest.
Are the deer more likely then to leave the forest and go down to some nice crop area?
Yeah, it seems so.
Yes. On the crops instead?
Yeah. So there's a double-edged sword to everything that happens in ecosystems. You see some benefit you like, it's going to lead to a cost you don't like. So there's a chance that the deer are moving out of the forests where wolves are present and into people's yards, into people's crops. But that vigilance of the deer seems to be helping against deer vehicle collisions, right? Returning to that research by Dr. Rayner. So it seems like the deer are watching out for the predators in their surroundings, and that includes being more careful when they cross the road.
Wow.
So you can sort of make a list of the things you like and dislike. scientists like myself try to avoid those value judgments. My personal preferences don't matter. What we want to do is measure all of those varied costs and benefits and then report them to the policymakers so the public can make a decision. How many deer do we want out there and how scared do we want them? How many wolves? How healthy are the packs of wolves? Those sorts of decisions need to be made by a well-informed public.
Well, like deer, wolves do seem to have a really good way of rebounding in their population. I recall maybe 40 years ago in Wisconsin, the wolf population was somewhere around 12 or 24, and Minnesota had a whopping 48 wolves at that time. And now it's, what, 500?
Wow, you're going to force me to do some math here on the air. So wolves have been eliminated from Wisconsin in the late 50s, early 60s. They started coming back in 1978, 1979. That's when I think the period you're alluding to, when there may have been a dozen wolves in Wisconsin. And at that point, Minnesota probably had 800 in that ballpark. You know, I don't have the figures on the tips of my fingers.
So it once reintroduced, wolves do just fine.
Yep. Or in the case of our state, where they recolonized on their own without the direct intervention of people, they can do fine wherever we don't persecute them. On the other hand, take a look at the history of the geographic spread of wolves through Wisconsin since about 2012. They have not increased their geographic range at all in that 12-year period.
Despite that population boom.
Despite the population increase. And that probably has to do with human-caused mortality. So people are killing enough wolves to keep them in the bounds that they've occupied since 2012.
A lot of car and wolf collisions then.
Gunshots.
Also people shooting them too.
Gunshots, the major cause of death of wolves nationwide.
What's the status of that in Wisconsin?
Well, we don't know. It's very difficult to study because it's illegal currently, as you alluded to in the lead up to this segment. So wolves are federally listed as endangered currently, and therefore it's illegal to kill them except in defense of human life. So under those conditions, it's extremely hard to study poaching. We do it in my lab, the Carnivore Coexistence Lab, namely research by Dr. Naomi Lauchauern and Dr. Francisco Santiago Avila and myself. We've quantified poaching by an indirect method, and that is the disappearance of the radio-collared wolves when they go off the air. A different kind of air than we're doing here, right? This is those collared wolves are being followed usually by planes that are picking up their VHF signals from the radio collars. And sometimes that VHF signal disappears. So the pilots fly broader and broader sweeps across the landscape and fail to find those wolves. That's when we begin asking questions about suspicious causes for those disappearances. Now, there's a small proportion of disappeared wolves that are not suspicious. The battery fails on the radio collar, or the animal leaves the state and can't be detected because it's decided to migrate to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan or to Minnesota. But a large proportion, and we're estimating about half of those disappeared wolves or more, are actually killed illegally and the collars are stolen, taken across state lines, or the collars destroyed.
Otherwise, though, it would be a pretty high burden of proof if you were caught with a wolf to prove that it was endangering human life.
Extremely high burden of proof, yes. It has to be an immediate harm. It's for someone traveling around with a dead wolf, if they're not going straight to the nearest DNR office, that's suspicious, correct?
Yeah. Do people in the DNR, do you know, ever go undercover for determining that kind of poaching, whether it's wolves or deer out of season or whatever it may be?
I'd be the last one to know.
Then they're doing a good job.
That's right.
I have heard of such things. In Maine in particular, I know it's been done.
Yes, and sometimes Fish and Wildlife Service goes undercover for major wildlife trafficking rings, correct?
Is there a point at which the wolf population is, we're saying, that's enough, and then we need to cull them? I mean, there is a wolf hunt, right?
There's a wolf hunt on the books in Wisconsin by statute. So when the wolves are removed from the federal list of endangered species, the state of Wisconsin may begin a legal public hunting, trapping, and hounding season on wolves. That's correct. Your question's an interesting one because it gets right at the theme of today's segment, which is coexisting with wildlife. So different people put a sort of a different definition on coexistence. They're talking about different things, even if they're using the same word, coexistence. Some people seem to think it's equating it with cohabitation, which is sort of one extreme that's too extreme, right? We have the word cohabitation for living under the same roof. No one's talking about that when they talk about coexistence with wolves, if they're being serious. The other extreme is to view coexistence as sufficient if there's wolves in a national park like Yellowstone or Grand Teton or Glacier. And that's usually not the coexistence that's being discussed when we're talking about states like Wisconsin, which don't have large national parks, right? These large, strictly protected places where you might be tempted to put a large, threatening wild animal and leave it there. So that's also not part of the discussion of coexistence with wolves in Wisconsin. Instead, we're talking about shared landscapes, shared habitats. And that's going to require tools and strategies for coexisting. For example, there are a lot of non-lethal methods for protecting people's domestic animals, like farm animals or farm dogs even. A lot of those non-lethal methods, such as livestock guarding dogs, those are special breeds, such as electric fencing, such as range riders, which are like herders up on horseback or on a quad vehicle that keep a close eye on livestock. Those non-lethal methods are excellent examples of coexistence strategies, right? Because the wolf is left alive, it's a non-lethal method, but so is the livestock and the person's livelihood is protected.
And how practical is that?
Oh, those are extremely practical. In my lab, we've tested them experimentally, so we know they're effective by the gold standard in science, which is the randomized controlled trial. So from that standpoint, they're practical in that if you put them into effect correctly, if you design it correctly, they will protect most 99% of the time, they're going to protect livestock. Is it financially practical? That's an individual decision that needs to be made by the livestock owners. Sometimes the state offers to help people afford those non-lethal methods. For example, Senator Booker out of New Jersey was one of the leads sponsoring congressional appropriations to generate a large, like multi-million dollar pool of money for states to use for non-lethal methods. In fact, for U.S. Department of Agriculture to hire experts in non-lethal methods to advise your average farmer, county, state government, whatever it might be, on the use of these non-lethal methods.
Is it true that wolves are not a threat to humans otherwise, other than, of course, indirectly through perhaps, you know, attacking livestock or something?
Well, in North America, it's highly accurate what you just said. So research by Dr. John Linnell shows that, and his colleagues, shows that in the last 18 years, there have been one or maybe two verified wolf attacks on people. That's 18 years across North America, right? And Canada has thousands and thousands of wolves. So two instances is so small, and it's probably just one, actually, that's so small, so rare that, you know, you and I face a greater risk stepping outside the door of our house and stepping onto the sidewalk than people have of facing attacks by wolves. On the other hand, Eurasia has had a higher rate, slightly higher. It's not a high enough rate where any scientist is recommending action against it, but I have to admit the possibility that in Eurasia you face a higher risk from wolves.
Wolves, of course, do have this kind of romantic association of representing the wild, the wilderness, and kind of a vast frontier. But what about that other canid, the coyote? That's a wild animal. How about coexisting with coyotes, and why the difference in policy?
Okay, yeah, just one comment about that idea of the wolf as a wilderness icon or a symbol of wilderness. That was pretty much discredited in the 70s and 80s by scientists who realized that, well, wolves were living in wilderness because that was the last place we had left them to live. They had been pushed back and eradicated everywhere else. And as soon as we reduced that killing, wolves showed that they could coexist with us in mixed-use landscapes like Wisconsin, right, which has no large protected areas in which farms are mixed with industrial timber, mixed with U.S. Forest Service lands, this real mosaic. Wolves are fine in that habitat. However, you do raise a super good question, a super interesting one about coyotes. So coyotes are a smaller cousin of wolves. My wife and I live a few hundred meters from a coyote pack that seems to produce pups every year. We hear the pups. We're delighted by it. And we've surveyed our neighbors. This is research led by Dr. Lisa Naughton, surveying our neighbors to find out how they feel about coyotes. And it turns out we live in one of the most positive places. Positive attitudes towards coyotes are sky high in our neck of the woods. And this actually echoes with research done in the greater Chicago area by Dr. Stan Garrett out of Ohio State University, where Dr. Garrett found that densities of coyotes were higher in urban Chicago and suburban Chicago than in rural Illinois, which is kind of mind-blowing, right?
It is.
And that has something to do with the tolerance or the behavior of people. Tolerance for coyotes, where they don't get shot, they manage to live near us, and many of us are completely unaware of their presence. And coyotes can do some useful things like controlling rodent populations, in some cases controlling Canadian geese overpopulation. That's a value judgment by residents of those areas. So coyotes are an interesting case, super good at coexisting with us, often unnoticed. But our policies are extremely lenient towards people who want to kill coyotes. Whether that's good or bad is a matter of your opinion and belief system. What we're finding more and more is that coyotes are equally important for the health of ecosystems, the way I described for wolves. Same applies to coyotes, but typically for the smaller prey animals, rabbits, squirrels, raccoons, mice. And where coyotes are encountering deer and there's no wolves, then the coyotes will also prey on deer calves. So some of the same benefits of predators accrue, not just due to wolves.
Well, speaking of the suburbs, if the question is not too dark to ask, I know in England, for example, an extreme example, but in this country too, I think to a lesser extent, the depletion of songbirds is a byproduct of cats. Coyotes like to eat cats?
Yes, in some cases, apparently they do. Yeah, I see your preamble about going dark.
from certain points of view, yeah.
Yeah, it depends on your point of view, definitely. The data on the national or international impact of cats on songbirds is pretty skimpy. Now, I think we need to acknowledge that they're effective predators. Some individual cats are super predators. Others are just lazy, and they're not going to hunt many birds. So there's a lot of variation, and that variation translates at whatever scale you're looking at, right? Namely, the impact on songbirds is going to vary, and in ways that we really haven't plumbed. So unfortunately, the debate about cats went nuclear before all the data were in, and that's always sort of regrettable because it makes it harder to do the science that we need. But yes, let's get back to coyotes and their effect on cats. In California in particular, there have been studies that show coyotes can reduce the free-range or the roaming cats population. And in places where coyotes are removed, not only do you get a lot of free-range cats, but then you suddenly get an increase in the smaller carnivores, raccoons, things like weasels and so forth. And those animals also bring costs and benefits, right? Raiding your trash, for instance, in the case of some raccoons. So every time we pull on a string in our ecosystems, we see something unravel somewhere else. And that's the kind of situation sometimes called a wicked problem that requires us to think two steps ahead, look at all the interacting, interlocking pieces of the puzzle before we meddle too much.
It's more complicated, doesn't it? So many variables when you start extending it out year by year like that.
Exactly.
We're going to look further at this concept of coexisting with wild animals when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Adrienne Trevis. And we are looking at the phenomenon of coexisting with wild animals as their habitat shrinks and ours gets more and more civilized. And we've been looking of late at wolves and coyotes, and they're both, you know, dog type animals, and yet some considerable differences in the way that they interact with humans, are there?
Yeah, coyotes seem to be able to live closer to us, and that might have something to do with their ability to breed successfully, even if there's just a pair of coyotes. You know, wolves can do that as well. You can have just an alpha male and an alpha female successfully raising a litter of pups, but all the data suggests that the larger the wolf pack, the more chance those pups live to adulthood. Whereas coyotes, it's a little less clear. Coyotes certainly can form large packs with stratified multi-generational structure. That means that the young of the year stick around and help the parents. But a lot of coyote packs are just those, that pair, that alpha male and alpha female. And that makes them able to live near us more easily than wolves, right? So coyotes need less space. That linear shape of a habitat is okay for coyotes. They don't need a block of habitat that's hundreds of square miles like a wolf does. And in addition, coyotes seem to thrive on rabbits and chipmunks and the smaller animals. So those are abundant in the suburbs now. So are wild turkeys that have come back big time in places like Madison. Quite a rebound. And that all makes it possible for coyotes to thrive in the suburbs. Yeah.
They probably wouldn't occupy the same territory, wouldn't compete for the same food source.
Well, the thing we find when wolves and coyotes live near each other is the coyotes get out-competed. That usually means they run the heck away from the wolves and abandon their territories if wolves can get at them too easily. Sometimes wolves will kill coyotes. So that results in a reduction in the density of coyotes. Wolves can have that effect. So if you don't like coyotes, you should like wolves, right? The enemy of your enemy is your friend. On the other hand, most people have a sort of hands-off, keep those predators away from me attitude to whether it's coyotes or wolves or mountain lions.
The coyotes will attack deer?
They can attack adult deer, especially in deep snow, but typically they're attacking fawns and young deer.
Let's move to another predator, which we hear about from time to time. Some years ago, I was in Southern California at the Will Rogers Ranch, taking a walk up into the hills on that property, and I see a sign that says, "Thank you very much. Watch out for mountain lions." Now that I'm up here, what am I supposed to do?
Right. Well, make a lot of noise. That's the first recommendation, because they're not hunting for you. In virtually every case, they want to avoid you. In fact, let me give you an anecdote. Before I start the anecdote, let's just make sure our listeners are aware. Mountain lion is the same thing as cougar, is the same thing as puma. That's all the same species. And it's the largest cat in North America. So here's the anecdote. Comes from Washington State. People put up trail cameras quite commonly, right? And in this one area in Washington, hikers were using this trail heavily. Mostly it was about people hiking, walking their dogs, even having picnics. As soon as there were no people in the frame, a mountain lion crossed the camera's path and crossed the path people were walking on and then disappeared into the forest. Nobody was aware. Right after that, people keep on walking by. No danger, right? So the chance that you're actually in trouble at risk with a cougar or a mountain lion is infinitesimal. It's maybe a little riskier than wolves, but it's still extremely low. And most of us go about our daily lives hoping to see them and never seeing them because they're so shy, they're so quiet, they're so elusive, and they really don't want to tangle with us in 99% or more of cases.
I've heard this said of wolves. I don't know if it's true of mountain lions, but essentially, wolves just have no interest in humans.
Right.
They're not considered to be predators, and they're certainly not considered to be prey.
Correct.
And it's so why even risk getting involved with a human?
I'd go even further. It's not that they don't have no interest in us. Most of them are actively scared of us. And that's from generations and generations of wolves being persecuted by people. We are bad news for them, and therefore they're shy. However, there's a number of people out there, including in northern Wisconsin, that have seen a wolf, and the wolf has seen them. And there's that moment of curiosity, mutual checking out, which almost always results in no problems. there are some people who are going to react badly to that kind of encounter and view it as threatening. In fact, one behavior of wolves that we love in our dogs, but wolves have it too, is that they'll look us in the eye. Most animals don't
they
look
do,
humans
I
in
know,
the eye.
And that, it's almost like that's a sign of intelligence.
Yeah. I mean, we love it in our dogs, right? Or a dog yes. we trust.
Yes. But they tend to be more wolf-like dogs, in my experience, that look you in the eye like that.
Oh, actually, golden retrievers are better at it than wolves are. And psychologists have done experiments on this.
So, fascinating.
Our domestic dogs are super, they're specialists at watching our facial expression and our eyes to try to predict what are we going to do. Wolves can do it, but they're not as good as dogs are. Nevertheless, people out there in the wild who see an animal, look them in the eye, perceive that as a threat. So it's all about the values you bring to the encounter. If you're there full of wonder and curiosity and you're not scared of eye contact, sometimes I get nervous about eye contact with people. But if you're not scared about eye contact with an animal, you know, enjoy the encounter. It's unlikely that that wolf is going to approach you and pose any threat. It's usually curiosity. So, you know, enjoy that encounter. Keep your distance.
Did they respond at all to the human voice?
By running away, yeah. Yeah. Not so much, not like saying commands or anything uh-huh. like that.
I mean, I'm asked just because I do this with deer occasionally when mm-hmm. I am walking and I suddenly there's one right there staring mm-hmm. at me and mm-hmm. I will talk to it and it will seem to try to figure out what the heck I'm saying, you know, before trotting off
yeah.
to be safe.
So next time you encounter any kind of animal, try this experiment. Don't make eye contact and try talking to it. I've noticed that animals will stick around longer if I don't make eye contact with them. Yeah, so I think a lot of prey animals view eye contact as a potential predatory interaction. So maybe people are justified in being scared of wolves for looking them in the eye, but we love that in our dogs. That's where the behavior originated in wolves.
Feel the same way about a mountain lion looking you in the eye?
Yeah, I would be fascinated, but I would also make myself big, make myself noisy. And don't turn and run.
But don't advance either?
No, don't advance either. Yeah. Yeah. Make slow movements. Make sure it knows you're there and that you're human.
Are mountain lion populations on the rebound also?
They seem to be, yeah. I'm not an expert on mountain lions, but for several decades, they were expanding. You know, east of the Mississippi, they'd been pretty much wiped out. They're now fairly well established in places like Wisconsin, Illinois, and perhaps in the northeast of the U.S. as well, maybe coming down from Canada.
How do they do with wolves?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question. It hasn't been studied a ton, but some research in Washington State that's very interesting suggests that wolves and cougars are splitting the habitat. Now, let me just clarify that. It's not that an individual cougar has an agreement with a wolf pack. They do it by some mutual avoidance and by specializing. So cougars, right, are very good at climbing trees, rocky hillsides, cliffs, and they can sometimes find prey that are trying to avoid the wolves, which are in the flatlands, the bottomlands, gentle slopes. So the cougars are specializing on a different kind of habitat and different prey when they coexist with wolves. And this is just mutual avoidance, mutual respect between the two predators. They don't want to get in a tangle.
But I have not heard, or at least I can't remember hearing about mountain lions being reintroduced the way wolves have.
There's one case of that, right, with the Texas panthers that were reintroduced into Florida to help the Florida panther recover because the Florida panthers were down to a handful of inbred individuals. So they brought new genetic stock from Texas to help the health of the Florida panther population. But you're right, wolves have made more of a splash with the reintroductions. Agreed.
A couple of, I'm going to say, exotic cases for Wisconsin because there seem to be so few of them. And they, I think, in both cases have been reintroduced in Wisconsin, moose and elk.
Yeah, I'm going to have to ask you to invite some of the experts on elk and moose to talk more intelligently about that.
Well, I know the moose had a problem with it was some parasite that they were getting from the deer territory, a brain parasite.
Yes, correct. And so moose are really struggling in Minnesota, the Upper Peninsula, Michigan, where they used to have healthy, dense populations. They seem to be retreating northward in association or in correlation with this brain worm, but also in correlation with climate change, making it warmer longer. For, you know, shorter winters.
And the elk, I mean, what's the difference, if I may ask such a basic question, between an elk and a deer?
Well, not such a basic question. They're in different genera. That's the plural of genus. So they're related, like cousins, but they're not closely related, like, say, mule deer and white-tailed deer.
Why would we want to reintroduce elk to Wisconsin?
You want the short or the long answer, Norman? The short answer is people want to see our native wildlife restored. And some people want to hunt them. Some people want to just appreciate them. Others might like an intact ecosystem for its health and benefits. The longer answer is that our country has a history of intense protection for wild species that are the game, the huntable species of certain people who want to hunt. And elk is among one of the prized hunted species in our country. So, the state agency that gets permit fees from hunters is going to bend heaven and hell to protect those rare prize huntable species.
They're revenue animals.
Yes. Which creates political problems for state agencies, namely that they may be paying too much attention to people who are paying a fee and less attention to the public whom they're legally duty-bound to serve as a whole. When they pay more attention to those who are paying fees to kill animals, that subtly shifts the attitude and culture of the agency away from protection of all of the biological diversity, all of the native wildlife species, you know, whether it's frogs, rare birds, snakes, fish. If they're not being caught and a fee being paid for them, the agency may ignore them to our own peril, to our own detriment, where we start losing species that are of no interest to hunters because the agency isn't paying attention.
Let's look at the relationship between humans and bears when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Adrian Travis, and we're looking at this phenomenon of coexisting with wild animals. We've looked at wolves and coyotes and the various kinds of mountain lions, and we've even touched on elk and moose along the way. One thing we do hear about from time to time is a conflict between humans and bears, which can prove not only hair-raising for the human, but also sometimes fatal.
That's right. There have been more human casualties of bears than any other of the large carnivores we've talked about here in North America. One of the questions I often get about bears is, well, I saw a grizzly, but it was really dark, and I saw a black bear that was really brown. How do we tell them apart? And basically, the color can be really misleading, although grizzly bears tend to be lighter in color. The grizzly is much, much heavier, much more massive. And so you get black bears living very close to people. Partly their small size, their shy, secretive habits allow them to coexist closer to people than grizzly bears. And when we talk about bears attacking people, far and away, grizzlies are more dangerous than black bears. A lot of people will have memories, because of our long lifespan as humans, we'll have memories of the terrible operations that were feeding bears in our national parks or allowing bears to raid garbage dumps. And those are the sorts of conditions that led to aggressive, bold bears that would break into houses or vehicles or threaten people. Now, that problem hasn't disappeared, but it's come under much better control thanks to the efforts of our national park services. So here in Wisconsin, we still get problems of coexistence with bears when Bears will damage the sweet corn crop in late August, or break into a shed to get bird seed or garbage. And people, you know, reasonably feel concerned about their safety and their property. And so we have fairly well-developed systems for dealing with that across North America, usually involving the live capture of that bear and then relocation of the bear. Sometimes it does lead to the death of the bear through, you know, what's called euthanasia, or death by injection of a lethal medicine. But for the most part, attitudes towards bears, so circling back to the topic at the start of this segment, attitudes towards bears tend to be far more positive than attitudes towards wolves or coyotes. And one thing my colleagues and I have tried to understand over the years is where that antipathy towards wolves and coyotes really comes from. Why bears are tolerated, even though they tend to be more dangerous, they cause more property damage.
Do they?
Yeah, than wolves. Oh, by far. For one thing, wolves are scarcer on the ground. But even if you consider coyotes versus bears, bears are causing more damage. It has something to do with bears being omnivores and able to tear apart property, like houses, with their...
houses. Yeah. Not to mention tents.
Tents, car windows, yeah. They have these very manipulable claws, and they're very strong. Plus, their ordinary wild foraging habits lead them to tear apart things like logs to get at insects. So they're quite used to tearing apart our structures to get at the tasty stuff inside. However, people tolerate bears, and maybe it has something to do with the way they look and that they're solitary, the bears are. Maybe they're more tolerated because we feel less threatened by them. Or maybe it has something to do with this eye contact between us and wolves, or that wolves are like a dog that's misbehaving. We think dogs should obey us, but wolves don't. And we don't expect bears to obey us, so we're less surprised when they cause damage. Maybe that's why.
Black bears have the reputation for being, well, I think you used the word shy earlier, more likely to just absent themselves yep. when humans come around.
Yeah.
Whereas grizzlies, maybe it's because they are found, if I'm right, almost exclusively in wilder, certainly non-residential areas. And you're more likely, therefore, to be one-on-one with them with no other humans around, no other activity around. And as you said also, Adrian, the grizzlies are much more imposing in their size.
Yeah, one symptom of the difference between the bears is the recommendation about how you should behave if you encounter the two species. So if you encounter a black bear, make yourself big, make a lot of noise. You can even run at it and scare it off. Don't do that with a grizzly bear.
If you can tell the difference.
If you can tell the difference, right. So it has a lot to do with people being well-informed about their ecosystem. And, you know, if you make a mistake in identifying a bear, make it in the direction of believing it's a grizzly bear. You're going to be safer then.
Because I imagine even a black bear, if provoked, say if it's a mother bear or something like that, could still do quite a bit of damage in
yes.
a conflict with any individual.
Correct. Yeah, you don't want to tangle with any of the wild animals we've been talking about today. Keep your distance, definitely.
What's the status of bears in Wisconsin?
I'm not really up to date on the latest count. I know it was a hotly contested and controversial issue about 10, 15 years ago. I'm not sure if that controversy settled down, but basically I could sum it up as saying we have an abundant black bear population. It's quite healthy. It seems to be growing and quite occasionally crosses the Wisconsin River into southern Wisconsin. So you have a chance to see one in our neck of the woods.
It has happened, yes. I know yeah. it has happened in the suburbs of Madison, at least a couple of times.
Correct, yes. We do not have grizzly bears here in Wisconsin.
Yeah. And what's the legality of bears in Wisconsin, though, in terms of bear seasons and bear management?
Yeah. Yeah. So black bears are a legal game species and have been. So it's been a longstanding legal public hunt for bears. One can hunt them over bait or with hounds.
Really? Almost anything?
Yep. You can even use bait and hounds. Some people stalk them to shoot them or fire a crossbow or a bow and arrow at them. Yeah, that's a long-standing hunt, and it's generally considered to be sustainable as it's currently managed.
Is there a bear season?
Yes, there is. So the bear season typically starts in the beginning of September and runs into the first week of October every year.
Yeah. Do those black bears in Wisconsin, do they hibernate? It sounds like there's some kind of like fine points to whether a bear strictly is hibernating or not, but the black bears do?
Yes. As soon as the temperature drops sufficiently or there's snow on the ground, you'll see bears starting their hibernation and building their dens and going underground. They generally stay there all winter, you know, until mid to late spring. However, it's not totally unknown that a wolf will leave its den for a short period, especially if there's a chance of finding food on the landscape, and then it will return to its den and continue that hibernation.
Or the bear will. And
yeah. So now that you've brought it up, I can't help but informing our listeners here, Norman, that there's fascinating data out of Yellowstone National Park where once the wolves were reintroduced to the park, the grizzly bears changed their behavior over the course of several years to a decade. And this is research reported by Dr. Doug Smith of the National Park Service.
To accommodate the wolves?
They changed their behavior to take advantage of the presence of wolves, not so much the wolves themselves, but the carcasses, the kills left by wolves on the landscape. So brown bears used to sleep through the winter when there were no wolves in Yellowstone.
Because there was no prey.
Because there was not much food on the landscape. It was covered with snow. You know how cold Yellowstone can be. And cold and snowy. But when the wolves were there, they don't hibernate. They're hunting year-round, and they're hunting elk, especially up in the highlands, in the lowlands during the winter. And so the wolves that kill an elk will leave a carcass on the ground for a while they feed it. They might come back to it even over 24, 48 hours and continue eating on that carcass. Grizzly bears can chase away a pack of wolves, especially at one of the smaller packs, and claim that carcass for themselves. So this was apparently enough incentive for them to leave their hibernation dens, look for food, and they were able to follow the crows and ravens that were the first ones to detect a carcass. So the bear comes trundling along, chases off all of the lesser scavengers, gets a nice snack, goes back in its den. It's a great system.
That's interesting because it's easy to have the conception that hibernating, you're just out for the count, and you're totally oblivious to anything. Your metabolism is down to way, you know, below standard and all that. But somehow they're awake, I mean, or at least aware of what's going on around them.
I'm not an expert on it, but I imagine it's a little bit like when we sleep and we surface from deep sleep
cycles.
Into different phases, cycles of sleep, exactly, yeah.
This is not a prey animal, but it's an animal that can be dangerous if you're not careful. I remember some years ago going through Custer State Park in South Dakota, and look, there's a buffalo or bison, if you prefer. Mm-hmm. And you know, everybody jumps out of the car, takes a picture. They go around the bend. Oh, here's six of them, you know. And then they go around again, and there might be a dozen. And well, it's time to get a close up.
Oof, yeah. You know, wildlife photography has made us all believe that we can get these fantastic shots, close-ups of animals. It's often not wise. There's a phrase for it in the wildlife field. It's the stupid tourist syndrome.
Some Darwinism at work there,
yeah,
I guess.
But, you know, I've been there in different parts of the world. When you see an animal like that, they're so majestic, you feel tempted to get too close. Yeah.
So even an animal that is I'm trying to think. Actually, would a buffalo even be a prey for, I guess, a wolf pack, maybe?
A wolf pack can take down a bison. It's a rare prey item, though. They're sort of specialized on the fast herd-living ungulates like elk and deer.
Any of those prey animals, though, even deer, how dangerous, for example, would be deer if you approach, I don't know, let's say a herd of deer.
You mean dangerous to humans?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I thought you were going to ask me how dangerous is it for wolves to pull down these prey.
Well, you know, you got to do what you got to do.
Right. Yeah, don't get close to bison. Those are huge animals. Even if they're just playing with you and they bump you, that could be serious damage. So, You know, in general, folks should stay away from wild animals. Enjoy them at a safe distance. That means like 20 yards, 30 yards. The faster the animal, make that distance even longer. Yeah. It's not that they're out to get us, but we're infringing on their space, right? Their personal space. So have respect.
Well, there'd be an interesting difference in the fight or flight impulses of these various animals when they're in some cases, yeah, they have one look at you and they're gone. And others, they think about it twice.
Yeah, that's great that you brought that up, because there's a lot of research on brown bears in Europe and Asia. Brown bear is their word for our grizzly, right? It's the same
species.
They
have them in Europe.
Yeah, they have them across Europe and Asia, brown bears. These are large animals, but the research that's been done in Scandinavia on grizzly bears that have GPS collars. That's like a radio collar, except a GPS reports their location more precisely and more often than we used to be able to do with radio collars. And they did experiments, the researchers did experiments where they had somebody naive, mainly uninformed about the grizzly's location, walk towards the approximate location of the grizzly bear wearing a GPS collar. And in every case, the grizzly bear left often before the human had any idea he or she was near the bear. The bear took off and kept traveling, sometimes for days. So any slight encounter with people has a big effect on these animals. And the closer we get, the effect is stronger. The disruption to their lives is stronger.
Well, they, as you said earlier, Adrian, have had plenty of experience with humans over the centuries and the millennia, and probably instinctively know there's some reason there are no more woolly mammoths or any number of other things that used to be roaming in the wilderness.
Yeah, these the bears and wolves and coyotes and cougars that we see today are the descendants of hundreds of generations that survived by being shy and avoiding people. Because if they weren't shy, if they didn't avoid people, they usually ended up dead.
On that note, it's been quite an interesting excursion into the wilderness with coexisting with wild animals, Adrian Travis.
Thank you very much. A pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland. Our engineer is Tom Blaine, and I hope you'll join us next time around for University of the Air.